This is Ron Orl, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited today to be speaking with David Hunker, who leads Ernst & Young's Shelter Activism Defense Practice, where he advises clients on preparing for and defending against activist investors. Before joining Ernst & Young, Hunker spent 17 years as an investment banker, most recently running activism defense at JP Morgan Chase & Company. Thanks, David, for taking the time.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so first, maybe you could tell us a little about your practice at Ernst & Young. My sense is you work with companies trying to ensure that they won't be targeted by an activist, but do you also work with companies that are currently being targeted by activists? Do you do both kinds of advice?
Yeah, we do. The primary focus for us really, though, is helping companies be proactive about looking at themselves, understanding how they might be vulnerable to an activist, understanding kind of what actionable items there are that they could be undertaking to help lessen those vulnerabilities, and having an idea of what they would do if they get that knock on the door one day. You know, so we're not out there chasing 13D filings and being one of the 30 calls that a CEO gets when an activist files something publicly. That said, we certainly will defend a client and have defended clients in live situations where we help them prepare.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you kind of approach a company and say, you know, these are your vulnerabilities that and an activist could potentially show up. And these are the kind of things you should do to protect yourselves or try to discourage an activist from ever knocking on the door.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of it is helping clients understand how activists look at companies, how activists are different than the rest of a company's institutional shareholder base. Mm-hmm. You know, many companies over the years that I've been doing this, when an activist has shown up and they've received a letter or an activist has filed a white paper, the management team and the board sit around and go, gosh, you know, this doesn't make a lot of sense to us, right? Mm-hmm. Or do these folks really even understand what we do? And so helping clients understand, hey, you know, your average shareholder, it doesn't understand your business the same way that you do. You're running it every day. The activist doesn't understand the business as well as you do because they're not running it every day like you are. Mm-hmm. And so helping them understand from more of a 10,000 foot level, you know, what those vulnerabilities are, and not letting a management team get caught up in the weeds so much on, you know, why might this critique or why might this plan for value creation not work, but more kind of, hey, why might that resonate with your existing shareholders?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's interesting. Definitely an important service. So I thought we could talk a little about, since we don't have a lot of time, about the proxy season so far. And so kind of shifting from the advising companies to avoid an activist to the situations where activists are materializing, that this is kind of an unusual proxy season, as you and I both know, where in September, the new SEC universal proxy card rules came effective that give investors more flexibility to choose between incumbent and distant director candidates in proxy contests that go the distance, because often when an activist shows up, if the company is not responding to its demands, they will nominate directors or their own director candidates. And there have been a few contests that have gone the distance with the new system, a lot of settlements. We've seen a lot of settlements this year. We see a lot of settlements every year, but this year, a particularly large amount of settlements. So there have been a few contests that went the distance. And one kind of interesting one that happened recently was at Pitney Bowes, where an activist, Curtis Wolf, a kind of up-and-coming activist, and his Hestia Capital Fund succeeded at getting 4 of 5 distant director candidates elected to the Postage and Mailing Service Company's board, which will be reduced in size to 9 members. So that was the first change of control contest to go the distance under the universal proxy card system, and was a big win for the activists. And they did get a fair amount of support from institutional shareholder services and influential proxy advisors. So, you know, we've seen some of these go the distance, but I have to say there was a lot of expectations that in some corners that the proxy season would explode this year. We'd see all these single topic environmental and social activists nominating directors for the first time. And I'm talking about, you know, the kind of activist investors that have historically submitted non-binding shareholder proposals at companies with environmental or social themes. For example, As You Sow, the expectation that these kind of funds would nominate directors because of the inexpensive cost of soliciting and essentially getting on the company's proxy card for distribution with director contests. And this didn't happen. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why you think that that didn't really happen, at least not so far. We're in May, well into the proxy season. And your thoughts, you had made a suggestion to me before, you might see some second and third tier type activists nominated. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, listen, I think when you separate out these two types of activists, one being the more traditional shareholder proposal activists, and the other being the value-oriented activists, you know, the hedge fund activists, I think in the first group, you know, the reason that we didn't see a lot of those proxy contests that were launched by those traditional shareholder proposal activists comes down to a few different factors. One is money, right? You know, many of these proponents, as you've mentioned, aren't actually shareholders in and of themselves. Right. They're coalitions of other shareholder groups that represent a number of shareholders. They do a lot of work to advocate for certain causes, but ultimately they have the support of other institutional or pension fund shareholders that are their members behind them. They don't have a big pocket of assets under management themselves to go out and fund a proxy contest. And listen, a proxy contest, even though under universal proxy, is less expensive than a proxy contest would have been under the old rules, it's still more expensive than simply getting a shareholder proposal put on the ballot, particularly when you get to things like the required solicitation to be included. So I think that's one. I think two is getting qualified candidates to serve as nominees, right? And again, there's not a big track record of these types of proponents or dissidents nominating slates, having kind of a stable of potential nominees at their beck and call. If you want to get someone elected, you know, shareholders are still focused on the quality of that candidate, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think the last thing is, let's go back and look at the support levels that these dissidents have gotten on their environmental or social proposals when they were proposal, right? Not trying to get folks elected. And while support levels from institutional shareholders certainly have increased over the last 5, 6, 7 years, they're not at the level that you see when a hedge fund activist shows up and nominates a slate, right? I mean, many of these ESG proposals, when they get on a ballot, ultimately are seeing 5, 10, maybe 15% support.
Right.
And so when you just all of that calculus, I think it means it's a bigger uphill battle for those non-hedge fund dissidents. Now, for the hedge funds, it's a much different story. I think a lot has to do with the macro environment that we've seen over the last year. These choppy markets have made it very difficult for particularly the smaller, you mentioned the second and third tier hedge funds, to really be able to underwrite a strong downside case. And so I think it's a function of those dissidents holding back until maybe there's more clarity and more certainty in what direction the equity markets are going. Whereas the larger, well-known brand name activists, you know, they have deeper pockets. And so they maybe have the ability to weather the storm a little bit more and be out there.
What did you mean by the second tier activists and the downside cases? So you're suggesting that even the second tier are not likely to use the universal proxy card for direct contests, or?
Yeah, listen, I think in uncertain markets like this, I think it's a bigger decision for an activist hedge fund with a much lower AUM to decide that they're going to deploy a lot of capital, put a lot of capital at risk, run a campaign, and who knows, even if they get their directors elected, if the equity markets move against them and they go underwater, that could have implications for the survivability of their fund versus a well-established large activist hedge fund. We all know who those folks are.
Yes.
That, you know, can go out there and say, hey, listen, it's still business as usual. I'm not as concerned about being underwater on an investment 4 months from now, 5 months from now. I have a longer term horizon. I'm not looking forward to raising fund two. I'm really deploying capital and, you know, I've already established my reputation in the market.
Yeah, it's interesting. So just to push back a little bit on what you're saying, but these smaller second tier activists need to develop their reputation as someone that can win a director contest. For example, this Hestia Kurt Wolf guy at Pitney Bowes, you know, he has had some success before, but this was a big win for him. So I suspect that now if he goes and he's not one of the top tier activists out there, But now maybe people will consider treat him more seriously if he comes up at another company. Maybe we'll settle in more his favor. I don't know. I'm just speculating. But I mean, it's a calculus they have to make where they need to be considered as someone that would be able to put a stick behind their word, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Certainly. And I think there are always going to be exceptions, right? But when you look back over the last few years, I think what you'll see is those smaller or newer activist hedge funds, lesser known or oftentimes unknown, many times are launching what many view as more marginal cases or marginal campaigns. Mm-hmm. I think certainly where the campaign thesis, underlying thesis is rock solid and it's clear that shareholders are going to support it, that's a different case, right? And that gives a lot of tailwind to any activist, large or small. But for those kind of more marginal activist campaigns, it's a much more difficult decision. Keep in mind, we're just really for the first time in modern activism, not in an equity environment where equities only go one direction.
Right.
Right. And so it takes a lot more stamina, a lot more confidence in the outcome of your campaign to launch today.
Okay. So I want to shift to this next thing that I want to talk about is something I'm seeing with more of some of the established, well-known activists that have a track record of proxy contests behind them. And I've seen more and more that some activists are nominating director candidates, one, more director candidates than there are seats available, particularly, let's say, at a company with a staggered board, staggered elections, where only 3 of 9 directors are up for election this year, and they nominate 4 candidates. And I guess you describe this as activists putting up a placeholder nominee. So explain to me, what is a placeholder nominee exactly?
Yeah, and I guess maybe I should be a little bit more clear versus kind of placeholder nominees versus, you know, this over-nominating trend, right? Where placeholder nominees, what we've seen where, you know, an activist has nominated a slate and been explicit that, hey, I'm nominating a slate because I haven't had enough time to actually determine the qualified slate that I think should be long-term directors on this board. So I'm going to nominate these 4 fund employees. And when they're elected, I'll tell the shareholders who my 4 permanent directors are. But when these 4 are elected, particularly, this is more specifically in a control contest, those directors will resign one by one and the remaining directors will seat my chosen permanent nominee.
Let me just make sure. So the activists will nominate its own people. And then are you saying that as the contest gets closer, they switch them out for outside candidates? Or you're saying once they get elected, then
yeah, so the placeholder is really they get their employees elected, but with the intent for those employees to resign and then the remaining board, the remaining directors to then nominate the chosen, you know, designee that the activist has chosen. And again, this is really an issue when an activist is coming up on a nomination deadline. Mm-hmm. They don't have that final slate ironed out. And so we've seen that. The over-nominating, we have seen that too. And it's really a curious issue because certainly none of these things have so far been fully adjudicated in Delaware or any other state, but, you know, have seen activists and have been involved in situations where activists have said, listen, I'm going to over-nominate and then I'll pare it down. Mm-hmm. I've been involved in situations where an activist says, I'm going to over-nominate in case the board decides to expand the class that's up for election.
Right.
After the nomination deadline, but before the proxies are finalized. Mm-hmm. So again, I think by and large, ultimately, these things are all likely going to get litigated if they go all the way to a vote or they're pressed all the way to a vote, but we're not there yet. I think there are differing opinions on, depending on if you're on the offensive side or the defensive side, on whether or not these things are even allowed. Mm-hmm. But it certainly is, you know, a novel strategy on the activist part.
I feel like there's one other aspect why they might be over-nominating, and that relates to another trend I've seen this year that I haven't really seen before, which is companies actually disqualifying director candidates for consideration or a candidate quitting because of some issue that the company found about them and was not disclosed originally through the advance notice bylaw questionnaire review period. So the activist wants to make sure they have enough nominees and not have to go scrambling around to look for a candidate when one quits for whatever reason or is disqualified. But one other thing that I thought that I saw that was kind of interesting is, and this is something I'm curious about, it's just something I don't understand about the whole proxy contest process, which is sometimes I see activists say, okay, we've nominated directors, but they won't tell us, you know, don't disclose publicly who those candidates are. For example, Starboard Value, one of the established activist hedge funds, said it's nominating directors at a company called LivePerson, but haven't disclosed publicly who those candidates are. So my question is, you don't have to talk about this particular case, but can activists nominate directors before the deadline, the nomination deadline, and not disclose those candidates to the company? Or do they have to at least disclose the names of those candidates to the company in advance of the nomination deadline?
Listen, I'm not a securities lawyer or regulatory attorney, so I'm not going to necessarily opine on whether or not they can or if it's allowable. I'll say that I've seen and been involved in similar situations where the activist has disclosed to the company who the nominees are, but they haven't necessarily disclosed those nominees publicly. Obviously, you know, those were all non-13D campaigns. No, the company doesn't necessarily need to publicly disclose those names, mm-hmm. right? And so in the cases where I've been involved, it's, you know, the activists using that as a tactic. Hey, here are these very highly qualified names that we're ready to go public with if you won't play ball with us now and settle. Right. So you can settle for two seats, or we're going to go public with all four of these names, and you can right. look at their bona fides. And we've already talked to shareholders. We know that shareholders are going to love these folks. And so use that as a lever to push companies into settlement discussions where they're not already in settlement.
Yeah, there was an interesting case at Shake Shack, the restaurant chain that just came yeah. out, which we first heard about one day that the activist had previously nominated a slate. We didn't know about it before. And then the next day, there was the day after he went public, the activist went public, or at least maybe 24 hours, 48 hours after it became publicly known that the activists had nominated Slate, there was a settlement.
So yeah.
It was a pretty fast settlement after that. So I wanted to talk a little about advance notice bylaws, where we don't have that much more time. And we saw a very high profile situation at a company called Masimo, which recently removed the bylaw seeking to get the names and addresses of the limited partner investors of any activists nominating directors at the medical technology company. This was removed after the activists agitating there, Paul Tan, Quinton Kofi, launched a Delaware lawsuit seeking to have that provision removed. There's another aspect of it that the lawsuit is still ongoing, but they removed the advance notice bylaw seeking to get the limited partner names of the activist investors, their investors disclosed. Of course, the activists said this is an existential threat, that they can't raise money. There's these confidentiality agreements between the limited partners and the activist fund itself. So I'm just wondering if you think, you know, this wasn't really litigated since the company removed that provision before it went to trial, but do you think we might see this kind of bylaw again, disclosing the names of the limited partner investors of the activist? Or do you think that we've seen the last of that?
I don't see this gaining traction, right? I certainly see the value in the other advance notice bylaw revisions that you've seen companies implement over the last 4 or 5 years to really close the gaps, suss out any reputational risk issues, legitimate business issues. But this seems like it would be hard to really gain a lot of traction. You go beyond the hedge funds as well. And would you expand this to a pension fund that wanted to put a proposal on the ballot, or if a pension fund wanted to make a nomination? I'm not saying that's going to happen anytime soon, but you have to disclose all of the members of the fund and the retirees. Right, the
California teachers, teachers, right?
I'm just and really, I don't know that this is something that, you know, the rest of the institutional shareholders are really going to support either, right? They don't want to necessarily start disclosing who their clients are. And so I think this is certainly, an interesting tactic. Listen, I tell clients all the time, activism is theater and politics. Uh-huh. And so there's a little bit on both sides sometimes of bluffing. Right. And so if you can do something that makes the other side think for a second before they take their next step, sometimes that can have value. But I don't see this extent of advance notice bylaw really, you know, becoming the norm anytime soon.
So I was at a conference recently and someone suggested to me that, you know, one strategy may be a step back from that, but still in the same vein, is to have a bylaw seeking to identify how long an activist investors and LPs, the limited partner investors, are locked up for. And I know that there's been certain situations where activists have come to me and actually told me that they have a special side pocket, whatever you want to call it, a special fund set up for a particular activist investment, and that their own limited partner investors are locked up for 5 years as part of that. Because this is part of this kind of marketing strategy that they want to send the message to the long-term institutional investor base, including index funds, that they have very long-term investors too, and therefore they're aligned with the long-term interests of the rest of the investor base. Of course, a lot of other activists, I suspect, have much shorter lockups, don't want to disclose how short those are, if there are any lockups at all, even. And this is something that companies would like to know, if the investor has to seek a quick turnaround or not. So I don't know. Is that something you think could pass muster, or you think, I suspect the activists might sue on that too. I don't know.
Listen, again, it's another kind of interesting angle, but I think the better display of alignment between the company's long-term shareholders and the activists' incentives is, hey, how long do you typically hold your positions? You kind of XYZ activist fund. If typically you're holding for 3-4 years, that certainly shows a different level of alignment than if you're holding for 4 months.
Right.
And whether or not your underlying LPs are redeeming capital or not, but if you're still holding on to that position, I think if I'm an institutional investor, that means a lot more to me than, you know, if you have a 5-year lockup, a 4-year lockup, a 3-year lockup, because even some of those funds with those long lockups, they're not holding their investments for more than, you know, 6 or 7 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. That's true. Sometimes some catalyst happens that the activist likes, even though they have a 5-year lockup with their LPs, and it's all over. So that's a good point. Okay, we are out of time. And this has been Ron Orl, and you've been listening to the Activist Venture Today podcast with David Unker of Ernst & Young. Thank you, David, for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.